Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Okay, some of you are wondering what that is I say, or the Dhamma talk, that is just traditional beginning of Dhamma talks, homage or remembrance of the Buddha, in honor of the Buddha. So all of these talks and all the reason why I give them and why we're all here at all, in a sense, are results of the Buddha. Monks are often reminded too that they're living on the Buddha's credit card. The reason why they get fed, why they get robes, shelter, all of these things is because the Buddha has set it up, and it wouldn't have happened if we just decided on our own. We don't have the kind of charisma and impact on the world that allows us to just go walking around living freely. We live in debt to the Buddha. We always have to remind ourselves of that. And when we give Dhamma talks, and this is very also for all of you who sometimes give Dhamma talks, or even in casual conversation talking about Dhamma, it's good to remember that you're representing the Buddha. It's important that you try your best not to misrepresent the teachings of the Buddha. He would have, he really, of all the things that a person could do for a Buddha, and what are they? He was sometimes asked, you know, disciples or people were very grateful for the kind of teachings he had given them and changed their lives in many ways, and they often thought, well, what, is there anything I can do for you? So mostly the one thing he would say, well, what you can do for me is practice those teachings. You know, if you practice them and benefit from them, that'll be my reward. But the other thing is that you can be careful with them as well, so that you represent the words of the Buddha correctly, with the intention. These days it's very easy to just kind of mix it all together in an eclectic bag of various teachings that seem appealing at the time, which is all right. There's a school in the West called fruit salad Buddhism, and it has a lot of delicious fruits from various traditions and teachings and so forth, which is all can be interesting, helpful, especially at certain times. Certain times certain teachings appeal to you, talk to you, and so forth. But we have to. That's all well and good. You just have to be careful with making the Buddha, making these words come out of the mouth of the Buddha. And this is I often hear these kind of melange of teachings given by various teachers, usually lay teachers, and they're interested in many different traditions, but they often, it's astonishing what the Buddha is credited with sometimes. So that is the kind of the reminder that the monk has before giving a teaching. He reminds himself, this is in honor of the Blessed One. Let me try my best to just represent give a balanced representation of the Buddha's teaching, appropriate to his instructions. So that's what that introduction is about. Today I'd like to just go on talking a little bit about the development of the factors of mindfulness and some approaches to it. You all, many of you cultivated the practice of energy last night, and also the perfection of what we call the perfection of patient endurance. and as well adhidhana, the capacity to determine, to make a determination, carry through with it. So those late night sits or often you think, what's the point of this? I'm just dragging myself through this. Maybe I should get a good night's sleep. Sometimes you need a good night's sleep. Sometimes it's good to drag yourself through something. Sometimes you get surprises too. You may think, oh, at many an all-night sitting, I've thought that about at 11 o'clock, this is not going to work. This is death. But then around midnight or so, you start to come back to life again. And then, of course, around 1:30, then you start to go back towards death again. And you think, this is it's only 1:30. I can't exist till 4 o'clock. This can't be. And then, 1:32 comes around, and you feel, I got my second wind here. All right. I'm going to fly through this. Now I see what I'm doing. I understand it. Of course, how could I have not seen this? This was clear, perfectly clear. Then 3:30 comes around and you think, what am I doing to myself here? I'm completely deluded and everybody else is here too. What we should be doing is going to sleep. And then, then you think usually 4 a.m. is the hour of death. It's the real end of it all. But of course, if you just beyond that, around 5:30, what happens is your natural wake-up rhythm starts to kick in. And you start to come back to life, and it seems like, that wasn't so bad after all. I feel fine. I thought I'd feel dead, So it's a kind of wavering back and forth. And this is, part of that idea is to watch your mind, how you tend to believe it. Whenever it says you believe, it says you're feeling fine. I'm feeling fine. I'm going to feel fine forever, actually. And then it tells you, you're not feeling very fine. You're really dragging your butt across the floor. And this is going to go on forever. It's never going to change. You're never going to be happy again. And we believe it each time. So putting ourselves in these situations where a little more polarity comes up is good for us to practice walking through it. Okay, wait a sec, let's just look at this. How bad is it? My body is heavy like lead. Feels like I got lead manacles on my wrists and on my ankles. My eyelids feel coated with something. My mouth doesn't taste good. Nothing appeals to me. So what? That's just the experience of the body. Let's not make more of it than it is. It's just sensation. Go back to looking at the sensation of it. Gently watching it. Not getting lost in it. And at the same time, when one floats across the room, when it passes, when it lifts, and one feels fine and energetic, then just remember, what is this feeling? The body feels light, feel cool and free and so forth. Just watching that as sensations and not getting lost in it. Ajahn Chah would often repeat that your mind is a liar. That's the nature of the mind. It lies to you all the time. It tells you things that are not true. And you should know by now. It's just, how many times has it told you stories that aren't true? Things change. Things pass. They're not that way. You don't feel that way. You won't feel that way. So this is one of the learning experiences of pushing. It doesn't matter how long. If you push for 1 minute past your comfort zone in terms of sitting, if you find that you're fine up to 42 minutes and then the knees start to hurt and so forth, then if you just last 3 minutes more, there's a new experience, a new type of meditation that's going on there, involving determination and going against the grain a little bit. And it's not for the sake of just mere gritting your teeth and so forth, or inflicting pain on yourself. It is just to watch how it pulls you in to a melodrama about your body. And how it really is, in the moment you know, unfold yourself and get up and walk, and then the relief happens, and then there's this rejoicing in the absence of pain, and then a minute or two later you've forgotten all about it. It's all in the past. You don't hardly remember the experience. So it's really your real interest is in watching that shift of moods and your elation and depression in accord with these mere sensations in the body. This is where you will gain wisdom, and the wisdom to stand aside and not get lost in these the whirlpools and eddies of bodily experience. Of course, it's also great for building up just this main virtue of patience, patient endurance. The Buddha said that patient endurance is the highest austerity. The word that he used was as a form of the Sanskrit word tapasi. Prior to the Buddha, these ascetics, the famous Hindu ascetics, went off into the woods and did various amazing things. They stood on one leg. They sat in front of a fire on a hot day. They lived underwater. Some of them, that's a good one. Lived in a marsh, and they breathed through a tube. And lived underwater. Is that interesting? and they were practicing austerities. The belief was that by doing these things that you gained a certain kind of profound power, and then these could be used. This is kind of shamanic tradition. By these exercises you would tap into something extraordinary, and then the society could use that power, or you could use that power for special knowledge and so forth. The Buddha wasn't much into that, any kind of bodily torment, but he did say that if you want to practice these tapas, these austerities, it's just the highest of these, the most meritorious resultant will come from the capacity to develop long enduring patience, which is this ability to be patient. This is the supreme austerity, and has the supreme result. So Ajahn Chah again would, in his main teaching around his monastery, which is a very austere kind of existence, he had arranged the monastery very much in accordance with the time of the Buddha. The same practices were done: one meal a day, alms round, barefoot, just a basic set of robes, a very minimal shelter, and quite often he'd ask you to just leave your kutis, leave your little cabins, and go off and just live under the trees. Maybe a mosquito net for just live on the ground. Which sounds, we kind of like that in camping around here, but try it in a tropical forest to get down on the ground. There's something that makes you don't want to get down on that ground, because there's so many centipedes and poisonous snakes and biting poisonous ants, and just one thing after another. It's alive, intensely alive. There's something about it that you just don't want to come out of your little kuti. The kuti is raised up on stilts, and there's a good reason for that. You just don't want to be down on the ground. So you would, it doesn't take much. You just say, and everybody has this nice little kuti. You'd say, okay, everybody just get out of their kutis and find a tree. And you just with amazing kind of resistance to that. In Canada, I used to love to go out camping. wandering around. It's great. You know, very benign. The winter kills everything. And that's, you know, we complain about the winter, but the reason why you have this kind of antiseptic glacier that you live in is it's the opposite, you know, it's full of kind of things wanting to eat each other and you. So you do that in order to, and of course you're up at 3 o'clock every morning and you're only eating once a day, and then once a week he says, now let's stay up all night. That's it. Let's have a little party. Let's stay up till dawn. You know. So it's right at the edge of what you can bear. And it's really. He says, you know, the main teaching here is just patience. But you can really learn what's going to really, the center of your practice is just going to be patient endurance. If you can discover that. This is the highest of the virtues, the highest thing. This is going to deliver you from suffering. And, you know, what is patience, really? It's, I remember somebody saying that patience isn't waiting. You're not waiting. You can't be patient and wait at the same time. You know, you're this notion of patiently waiting for a bus. No, you're either patient or you're waiting, but you're not patiently waiting. Patience, the real essence of patience would be the lack of suffering, the lack of anticipation, the lack of leaning forward into the future that you can't do. And waiting is a form of suffering, a psychological condition called waiting. Why are you waiting? Or it's somewhere you've got a relationship to the future. There's some sort of conceptual relationship that there is a future, and that this is not the time. This the present is not the time and the place where you want to be. You want to be in the future, so you're waiting for that future to appear. And that waiting is internal tension and strain. It's a very active waiting. It's not just your body. I mean, this is. all kinds of events are going to take place in your life, and you unknowingly are waiting for those. In that case, there's no stress, no strain. But when you know about some event coming up, and you feel yourself, I'm waiting for something to occur, that is one definition of dukkha, of suffering. So patience is to learn to be, and to allow the present to just be there, and to allow you to be just in the present. It is really another way of talking about being in the present. We often emphasize mindfulness as well. Be mindful of the present. Be mindful of the present. Another, a reverse way of talking about it is just to be patient. To allow yourself to be in the present. Not to strain into the future. Not to wait for anything. Don't wait. Be here. Patiently. So that's what, you know, instead of straining for 4 a.m., wishing, wanting, or straining to get back into your puti, whatever, straining for things to happen, we just wait. We just learn to be patient in a little bit. And patience, again, unfolds. These virtues all unfold into a kind of central reality. They're all moving towards the end of suffering, which is suffering is always some sort of condition of tension or stress or being at odds with the way things are. So another way of putting the Dhamma is that you're moving back into you're seeking to understand the way things are. When you understand the way things are, you're perfectly patient. When you suffer, you are failing to fully realize the way things are, the way it is. I'd like to read a little excerpt from a sutta, and this is a very good one to remember. Nice little parable. This is called the Parable of the Cook. This one is good to have in your kitchen. up on your refrigerator or maybe up above your dining room table or something. Of course, this is not really about cooking. It is about, you are, in a sense, we're all cooking here. We're baking something. We have something in the oven. Our practice is, you know, is what we're developing. It's like bread. You know, we've kneaded the bread and spent some time dealing with the bread, used cold water, all of this kind of stuff, and we're letting it rise, and then we're putting it in the oven and baking it and so forth. Well, for most of us, it's only half-baked at the moment, but it is a kind of a very close idea, and the results will be delicious if we do it right, the same kind of patience. But there are foolish cooks and there are wise cooks. So this is a little parable about the foolish cook. Suppose that there is a foolish, inexperienced, unskillful cook who has presented a king or a king's minister with various kinds of curry, mainly sour, mainly bitter, mainly peppery, mainly sweet, alkaline or non-alkaline. He does not take note. That is, he does not pick up the theme of his master, thinking, today my master likes this curry, or he reaches out for that curry, or he takes a lot of this curry, or he praises that curry. As a result, he is not rewarded with clothing or wages or gifts. Why is that? Because the foolish, inexperienced, unskillful cook does not pick up on the theme of his own master. In the same way, there are cases where a foolish, inexperienced, unskillful monk remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. As he remains thus focused on the body in and of itself, his mind does not become concentrated. His defilements, that is, the five hindrances, are not abandoned. He does not take note of that fact. He does not pick up on that theme. He remains focused on feelings in and of themselves, the mind in and of itself, Dhamma categories in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. As he remains thus focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, his mind does not become concentrated. His defilements are not abandoned. He does not take note of that fact. As a result, he is not rewarded with a pleasant abiding here and now, nor with mindfulness and alertness. Why is that? Because the foolish, inexperienced, unskillful monk does not take note of his own mind, does not pick up on the theme of his own mind. Now suppose that there is a wise, experienced, skillful cook who has presented a king or a king's minister with various kinds of curry. He takes note of his master, thinking, today my master likes curry, or he reaches out for that curry, or he takes a lot of this curry, or he praises that curry. As a result, he is rewarded with clothing, wages, and gift. Why is that? Because the wise, experienced, skillful cook picks up on the theme of his own master. In the same way, there are cases where a wise, experienced, skillful monk remains focused on the body in and of itself, feelings in and of themselves, the mind in and of itself, Dhamma categories in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. As he remains thus focused on mental qualities in and of themselves, his mind becomes concentrated. His defilements are abandoned. He takes note of that fact. As a result, he is rewarded with a pleasant abiding here and now, together with mindfulness and alertness. Why is that? Because the wise, experienced, skillful monk picks up on the theme of his own mind. So that is failing to learn about yourself, understand your own character, fail to keep yourself under observation, understand your own how your own mind works and the preferences. You are, in a sense, rotely going through the preparations for mindfulness. You're just going through the motions of it, but you are not eagerly and with vital interest attending to your mind's response to these things. You're not adjusting and questioning and asking yourself, how can I let go of this? How can I keep it here? So forth. Not paying attention to the qualities of your own mind, what your own mind needs. And also in reference to that, so let's say that you do attain some concentration sometime. Your mind clears up. Right at that moment, it's not that we should be so interested in the experience, although it's a very pleasant experience. The mind, the body lightens up, the mind opens up, the clarity comes. At that point, we don't want to just plunge into that and just forget about everything. We want to ask ourselves, what's more important is, like, how did that happen? We can even interrupt or disturb that concentration, because what we want to do is we're more interested in, even if we have a perfect loaf of bread coming out of the oven, it's nice to fall on it and eat it and so forth, but in terms of the future, what's more important is recalling exactly what were the process in there. You know, with the bread thing, I don't know much about making bread, but I understand there's quite a difference if you use cold water sometimes, you know, for the mixing of things. Like, small things make a difference, and it is paying attention just to the small aspects of this, to the preliminaries, how it was done. Why did it work that way? Did you preheat the oven long enough? What was the temperature in the room? What was the time of day? In the same way, you want to be very, very careful. Your primary, and especially in a meditation retreat, you have this kind of, you've taken time, a chunk of time out of your life, and this is very much a workshop. And your primary interest is in, you can experiment with various things that bring this about, a pleasant abiding here and now. The hindrances have subsided. You know. Something has emerged. Clarity, serenity has emerged. How did I do that? You're really interested in being able to reproduce that experience. And so one of your main concerns is, like, how do I slip off the edge? How do these moods come over me? How do I buy into it? How do I let them go? Or is very interested in the how of it and the why of it rather than the experience itself. We actually have set aside all this time so that you do have the opportunity to have a deeper experience than in normal life. Normal life, because of your interaction, is difficult to find time to set aside to actually get at some degree of absorption, a sort of a change of a focus. There are things to do that keeps you, you could certainly be practicing mindfulness and all these things, but sometimes to have a regular low sensory environment where you're supported by other people that have all this time to sit is a great opportunity for coming close to the experience of a pleasant abiding here and now. But again, what we want to take away from it is it's more important that we understand how that happened than the fact that it did happen, or the pleasure of it, or remembering for years afterwards that there was this, I had this great experience, I wonder what it was. I keep, you know, wishing or hoping that it comes back. But it's not a matter of wishing or hoping, it's understanding how that happened, how that was arranged. Being very careful to note how this happens, or also noting why it doesn't happen. What didn't the king like about that dish? Too much salt in it or something. You know, you're observing. He reaches for it. He likes that. The expression on his face is he likes that. He takes it over, takes a spoonful, and then doesn't take any more. You want to note that. What is it? That's the same process of watching your own mind. You take up the subject of loving kindness. You reflect on. You start, say, thinking, I must be loving for my enemies. And you decide, okay, goodwill towards. You bring up this person, and you note that that after a few minutes you'd lose interest in the exercise. You think, I think I'll go back to my breath. I'm doing much with this. You have watch what happened there. You unskillfully introduced something that was you were not ready for. You jumped to somebody you have your aversion for, strong aversion for. And then the mind manufactures or rationalizes a reason why you should be doing something else. Note that. It doesn't like that. It found it tastes not so good. It's supposed to be its favorite dish, loving kindness. Who doesn't like loving kindness? The Buddha says, sweets, who does not like sweets? loving kindness, who does not like loving kindness? Why then do we come, you know, want to do something else? Because we've taken it up in an unskillful way. Maybe what we should do then is try another dish that the mind prefers. Start with your best friend. See how that feels. Then the emotion comes up, and you say, I like this. The mind liked that. He liked that. He enjoys that dish. He reaches for it again. So again, the image of the friend coming up, the warmth of the emotion coming up. And then the next dish, outward, radiating it outward to people who are not a little bit more distant, anonymous people and so forth, seeing how this goes, watching very skillful. Not just bringing up what you're supposed, you know, what you think you're supposed to do, but asking yourself, how am I really responding to this? I was telling you about the experience when I was a hermit. And maybe it was this group, I'm not sure. Too many retreats. Maybe it was the other group. Sitting in my hermit shack from morning to night, lots of time, hardly any, you know, visitors, sometimes weeks at a time between seeing humans. So I was under the impression that one should just ignore mental, you know, the hindrances and so forth, and just sit through it. Just basically hadn't really reflected too well. So I was making a good determination to sit. So I'd be very tired, and I'd stay doing sitting meditation, watching my breath while I'm very tired, and I'd be very drowsy, nodding off. Right? I would just keep sitting there, you know, struggling with this. And when this went on for months, I kept thinking, well, you know, somehow I'll break through this. Then it occurred to me, maybe that's the wrong tactic. Because I was under the impression that, you know, just catering to your whims, like getting up and doing something else, was the wrong thing. But the basic instruction was that, you know, what instead of getting up and flicking on the TV and forgetting all about meditation, that's not what you should do. But the idea that you can change your posture, that you can get up and do walking meditation, that you can splash water in your face, that you can take some deep breaths, that you can change the subject to a discursive thought, didn't occur to me. Finally, it did occur to me. I started doing that, and then, I woke up. That's much better for me. My mind rejoices at, you know, 8:30 in the evening, having been up since, say, 4 in the morning. That's a particular difficult time. Maybe that's not the time to do breathing meditation, not just to sit motionless. So I understood, changed it. Very shortly after that, I flipped open the Visuddhimagga, this great book of teaching, flipped it open. There it was, exactly what I had discovered. I should have just read it out of the book. I mean, when he's drowsy and sluggish, he does not sit there, he gets up, he walks. Exactly. Looking back, how you wonder how you could be so senseless about the matter. But, you know, you hear a lot of instructions, and some of them sound like you've got to do this, and even if it doesn't work out, you've got to do this. So it's good to go review your instructions. I should just, again, read a little excerpt on that very issue, right from the Buddha. I mentioned that that I had picked up the Visuddhimagga and come across this. But let's see. right here. This is actually the words of the Buddha himself as well, not just the Visuddhimagga. This is a simile called fire. Monks, on occasions when the mind is sluggish, that is the wrong time to develop serenity as a factor of awakening. You know, the fourth factor, past. You can get up and do walking meditation. It can splash water in your face. You can take some deep breaths. Wet grass in it, wet cow dung, and wet sticks were to give it a spray of water and smother it with dust. Is it possible that he would make a small fire blaze up? The monks reply, "No, Lord." Wouldn't you like the Buddha for a teacher? He really gives you the easy, everybody gets 100% on his exams. Does that sound like an easy way to make a fire? No. But, you know, obviously I failed the exam. I mean, I was sitting there trying to make this fire with wet cow dung, grass, spray some water on it, and throw dust on it at 8:30 in the evening in my little hermitage. So I would have said, "Yes, Lord." No, Sona, that is not the way. In the same way, when the mind is sluggish, that is the wrong time to develop serenity as a factor of awakening, concentration as a factor of awakening, equanimity as a factor of awakening. Why is that? The sluggish mind is hard to raise up by those mental qualities. Now, on occasions when the mind is sluggish, that is the right time to develop analysis of qualities as a factor of awakening. Analysis of qualities is the second of the factors of enlightenment. That is investigation of Dhamma. He just translated it differently than I do. He calls it analysis of qualities. It's a good way of speaking of it. You're analyzing, you're actually investigating Dhamma with interest in terms of the flow of feelings. You're watching feelings rise and pass away. You're watching mental states rise and pass away. This is investigation of Dhamma. You're seeing the mark of impermanence in things. You're seeing the insubstantial nature of reality. That's investigation of Dhamma. This is something, it takes your interest. You know, it pulls your interest in it. It's a different activity, and it's the active, energetic side of things. That is what you should do when the mind is sluggish. Switch. Why is that? The sluggish mind is easy to raise up by those mental qualities. Just as if a man wanting to make a small fire blaze up were to place dry grass in it, dry cow dung and dry sticks, were to blow on it with his mouth and not smother it with dust, is it possible that he would make a small fire blaze up? Yes, Lord. In the same way, when the mind is sluggish, that is the right time to develop analysis or investigation of Dhamma as a factor of awakening. Persistence, that is energy. He translates it as persistence. I call it energy. And almost everybody does. Ajahn Tanisarasol is just a little bit different. The word is virya in Pali, and virtually everybody translates this as energy. My faculty of energy. One of the factors of enlightenment is energy. Energetic persistence, let's call it that. Energetic persistence, that's the time to rouse energy as a factor of awakening. And a rapture as a factor of awakening. When you're really tired and all, you gotta raise up some joy in yourself, some energy, joy. Don't go to see how mellow I can get. That is not the time to be mellow. That is the time to rouse energy and joy. Very deliberately. You know, walking around, taking deep breaths, splashing water in your face, thinking you can bring images of the sky to mind, light to mind. You can imagine light. You can look out at light. You can think expansive, active types of thoughts, very deliberately rousing them. Now, on occasion, when the mind is restless, that's the wrong time to develop the analysis of qualities as a factor of awakening. And in other words, that's the wrong time to investigate the Dhamma when you're restless. energy. It's also the wrong time when you're restless to try to rouse energy. And it's also the wrong time to rouse joy or rapture as a factor of awakening. Why is that? The restless mind is hard to calm down with those mental qualities. Just as if a man wanting to put out a large fire were to place dry grass in it, dry cow dung and dry sticks, were to blow on it with his mouth and not smother it with dust, is it possible that he would put it out? No, Lord. In the same way, when the mind is restless, that is the wrong time to develop the investigation of Dhamma as a factor of awakening, energy as a factor of awakening, rapture, joy as a factor of awakening. Now, on occasions when the mind is restless, that is the right time to develop serenity as a factor of awakening, concentration as a factor of awakening, equanimity as a factor of awakening. Why is that? The restless mind is easy to calm down with those mental qualities. Just as if a man wanting to put out a large fire were to place wet grass in it, wet cow dung, wet sticks, were to give it a spray of water and smother it with dust, is it possible that he would put it out? Yes, Lord. In the same way, when the mind is restless, that is the right time to develop serenity as a factor of awakening, concentration as a factor of awakening, equanimity as a factor of awakening. Why is that? The restless mind is easy to calm down with those mental qualities. We have left out one of the seven factors. Mindfulness. The last sentence of this. As for mindfulness, I tell you, that is beneficial everywhere. That one works always. But the other ones don't. The mindfulness is the... Remember I was mentioning that mindfulness is the center of the teeter-totter. And then the three active qualities, investigation, analytical investigation, the rousing of energy, and joy, rapture, are the active side, and that's on the side of the teeter-totter. And then the others, serenity, concentration, equanimity, are on that side. Mindfulness is the one that's shifting the little scale back and forth. When it's feeling that the energy, equanimity, passive, focused things are out of balance, then it starts to rouse up the active side. And then you start to feel yourself getting a little bit too bubbly, and then you start to focus the mind down into topics of serenity. Such as the breath, it's a topic of serenity. Loving kindness is a topic of serenity. Conduces to calm. The mind, one of the 11 benefits of loving kindness is the mind is easily calmed. The countenance becomes serene. The face of a person who is full of look at these paintings in the wall, in the walls up in these halls. They're all trying to capture this expression. Is you get pictures of Mother Mary and saints and so forth. They all have this incredible relaxed countenance on them. This extreme serenity coming out of them. Because the primary virtue in those types of paintings are compassion and love. So you get that the countenance becomes serene. All the muscles, the finer muscles of the face relax. Take on a certain kind of expression that these great artists seem to be able to capture just this quality of serenity that comes out. Also, things like the color, just visualization of color can be a way of inducing a calmness and serenity. It's called the color casino. And this is one of the... There are four color casinos that, or the visual, which are just primary colors. You can pull to mind just a field of blue within the mind, shutting the eyes, imagining a field of blue. Or actually just looking at the sky. In the prairies, you got lots of sky to look at. In BC, you have to look up there, because the mountains take up half the sky. So here you got this nice field of serene blue as well. Also the elements, not in terms of the analysis of the body elements, because that's involving analytical kind of things, but just looking at, for instance, go out by the fountain. If you're feeling restless, agitated, can't settle your mind down, just sit by the fountain. I think there's some benches out there, and then just look at the water. Don't analyze it. Don't think. You know. Don't try to think. I'm the water. It's the water. The water's flowing. The water's impermanent. The water's this. The water. Just look at the water, and rest the mind on the water element. Just become one with the water. And then you can even, after you've done that for a while, you can close your eyes and then bring that back with you. When you're just sitting, you can sit down in front of the water. It's a visual, visualization. Just sitting down in front, recalling the element of water has a soothing, restorative quality of water. Flowing water and then still water, and you can change from one at first, maybe some moving water, and then the water becoming more and more still until it's glass smooth. This image of water, the recollection of water, water element, is a serene induction of serenity. So it's a little bit of exploration about what to do and to be remembering. Find out what the mind likes, what it responds to. Be a skillful cook. Do not ignore your customers' tastes. Don't say, just think, they'll like this. Watch what... what they like. People are strange. You're strange.